Hello and welcome to episode 319 of the Mark and Me podcast. As always, I'm your host, Mark. Now, joining me on today's episode is the writer, director, and producer, Julie Cohen. Today, we talk about a number of her documentaries that she's made, but mostly focus on her brand new documentary called Everybody. Truly, it's one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. This year, it is my number one documentary, and it focuses on three individuals that overcame shame, secrecy, and surgery throughout their childhood, and honestly, it is absolutely mesmerizing. I won't go into it too much because I never want to spoil it, but as you're listening to this right now, it is showing in the UK in a number of cinemas, so please go and check it out. It's absolutely brilliant. And on today's interview, you'll hear so much more, and I will never spoil it, so I'm not going to give you any more info than just it's an amazing documentary, it's beautifully made, very well respectful, and just absolutely awesome. And it's such a great chat with Julie today. But before I get there, let's quickly touch base and talk about my last episode. I was joined by Tom from the amazing band Plain White Tees. This blew up. Thanks so much to Tom and the band for sharing this on your socials. It really helped boost the numbers, and I've had a great response from everyone that checked it out, so thank you so much. But today, it's all about Julie Cohen, and honestly, one of the best documentary makers I've ever spoken to. So I think the best thing to do now is to get straight to it. So here's me and Julie, talking all things Everybody. So Julie, thank you for joining me today on the Mark and Me podcast.
It's great to be here.
What I love to do, Julie, with every guest that I get on is basically take it right back to the very start. And I'm really intrigued, when you're growing up, what were those first films or TV shows or even documentaries that made you fall in love with that kind of industry and that world?
Yes. Well, we could take a lot of time going through all my favorites of all the genres. So I think I will talk about early documentaries that had a big impact on me. Documentaries were not a huge thing until quite recently, but I found myself, I would say, checking out quite a number of the early popular documentaries. I absolutely loved Buena Vista Social Club, which I remember seeing
Amazing.
In a theater, the beautiful film about Cuban musicians that had so much, had a lot of music in it, but was not at all a performance film, was really letting you get to know these musicians and what life was like in Cuba, and had such beautiful, both visual and audio colors in it. And of course, like every filmmaker of my generation, I would say that Roger and Me was hugely influential for me. The Michael Moore film set in Flint, Michigan, where he himself is really a major part of the film, but also has just an incredible filmmaking technique in it that I still remember and even use to this day. There is an incredible scene where he's interviewing a man who has recently been released from a mental institution, and he's talking about just his deep sadness, and he's contrasting saying how he used to feel when he would hear the Beach Boys' incredibly upbeat and romantic song, Wouldn't It Be Nice? And from that, it's a really sad conversation. And from that sad conversation, more cuts to the incredibly melodic, upbeat Beach Boys song, Wouldn't It Be Nice, which I love going in anyway. And as you're hearing that music, you're seeing tracking shots of the dilapidated streets of Flint, Michigan. And it is an incredibly powerful juxtaposition, and taught me the interesting lesson that when you're creating a scene, if the audio and video fight with one another, if they're saying the opposite things, the picture always wins. Like the impression that you come away from that scene, that's like happy music, depressing scenes, depressing visuals, is just like sadness. And in fact, it makes the sad visuals even sadder to have that happy music. And it really kind of amplifies the whole effect. And it's It's something that I've used in films myself because it made such an impression on me, and so it was such a beautiful moment in a film.
I've never really thought about that contrast till you talk about it, and then now you've said it, I can picture many scenes, especially with many documentaries I see. But yeah, I suppose it just highlights or emphasizes more the emotion of either the happy or the sad with the, whichever obviously music choice you think. And when you think of the Beach Boys, I always think of singing happy, singing along, right. The sun's out, you're driving. So to put that then obviously with something negative or quite heart wrenching really does kind of pull on the heartstrings.
The scene was much more powerful than it would have been if he had played depressing music to match the depressing pictures. It was the contrast, and the incredible thing was that the soundbite right before it, that's what the guy is talking about. He's talking about his own internal contrast that he felt when he would hear that song and think like, am I ever going to feel that way? Can I ever feel like romantic and optimistic? And, you know, his doubts about it, and just really, really one of the most beautiful moments ever in film, I think.
And what point was it in your career? Was it after school or college that you decided to go down the route of filmmaking and documentary making? Or was it later on in life?
It was later. It was, I was a philosophy major, so make of that what you will. But then I went to graduate school in journalism and became a more traditional journalist for a lot of my career. Like I had I had 20 years of just straight out journalism, both in print, in radio, and in television. And it was after my television journalism experience, and I was working in kind of long form television journalism on a primetime program, mostly true crime program, where we were doing like 1-hour and 2-hour long stories. And I enjoyed that for a while. And then I kind of felt like I wanted to take the skills that I had developed, the storytelling skills from that, and just the straight out kind of logistical skills that you need to create long pieces, and move that towards subject matter that I felt was more kind of what I wanted to focus on for the next chapter of my life. And that's when I left NBC News to start making documentaries.
Well, at that point, obviously going from such a career change, what was it you wanted to do? Was it to tell stories through vision that you just meant a lot to you personally? Was that your kind of goal, just to try and make as many documentaries as you can to talk about those issues?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I had a hope of focusing on kind of stories that had some real substance and meaning to them, but that I would be able to approach from an optimistic, hopeful, loving, and even comedic light. I think a number of films that I've worked on, if you describe them in a log line, you know, in one sentence, might sound like kind of a downer. And yet I actually really try hard to make movies that are upbeat and entertaining and fun to watch. I certainly think that's true of the current one, Everybody, which has a lot to do with really difficult subjects, not only gender identity, but even, you know, non-consensual, you know, genital surgeries. And yet the movie overall has a lot of lightness, a lot of humor, a lot of music, and a lot of love in it. Because that's kind of like how I like to make movies.
I've been lucky enough to see obviously an advanced screening of it prior to this interview, and I actually completely agree. I felt uplifted and positive at the end that there's a better future ahead. But it was important that we saw the ugly side and the tough times that people have had to give a true reflection. I thought what was really good about your feature documentary is that it wasn't biased. It was just giving everybody a true reflection of the tough times that people have had, but also the journeys that people's lives are. And it's real. It's not like it's a topic that isn't still in today's society. If anything, it's more relevant today and in the near future than it's ever been.
I think that's right. And I think that the relevance and kind of the rise of this issue in society has a lot to do with the intersex community themselves and the conscious decision that a number of intersex people have made to talk kind of openly and loudly about their lives, despite almost to a person having been raised with a strong message that this is not something you should discuss. Yeah. In some cases, people aren't told themselves. And when they are, there's an accompanying message, either implicit or explicit, that this is something that you should talk about only to your doctor. If you mention it to a friend or, God forbid, a potential romantic partner, they're just going to reject you. So don't talk about it. Like, that's never a great message for people, but like, it's, for some reason, it's taken our societies. And I would certainly, I mean, I think things differ. I can't speak to too much of the world, but I actually think both American and British society, I lived in England for a year. I'm not saying I'm a great expert, but I do have some England experience and have been there many times. I think there is a shared lack of openness in our cultures, that there's sort of like things to be kept secret, and like the little shames that we just bury in a box and like never talk about them again. That never ends well. I'm not a mental health professional, but I've been around the world for a while. I'm about to turn 60, and one thing I know is that like telling people to keep parts of themselves secret just like doesn't end well.
No, there's nothing that good can come from that. And I was kind of intrigued on how the journey of this documentary came about, because obviously the topic is so relevant, but so personal. And to find people that would participate in this, especially the three leads that we see all through and are very honest and very open about their lives, and we get a really deep insight to how their days are. Did it come about by the fact that you wanted to tell the story about this? Was it about, I'm really intrigued when documentary makers have an idea and then it actually gets greenlit to them finally make a documentary.
Yeah, well, this project took a long time and started in a completely different direction.
Right.
As I mentioned, I worked at NBC News for many years before I started making docs. And even since then, I've gone back and done some work for them from time to time. And often what I've done is development work, you know, where they're having me look for stories and look for things for them to follow. And in this case, they had invited me back in 2018 because they were starting a whole new branch of NBC News called NBC News Studios, where they wanted to create documentaries for other, yes. So NBC News had invited me back to look through their archives for stories that might make good jumping off points for feature docs. And the story that I immediately gravitated to was an old NBC News story from the late 90s that is not about intersex people, but has an impact on intersex people and actually appears in the middle of the film. I don't know how deeply to go into it. It's the story of David Reimer, a boy in Canada, not an intersex boy, just a biological boy who had his penis injured in a botched circumcision, and who, under the guidance of a medical team, was told, his parents were advised, that the best way to raise this child, rather than being a boy with an injured penis, which is what he would, that it would be better to turn him into a girl and raise him as a girl, do surgeries, give hormones, do a whole psychological protocol around him, never tell him his background, and just like, oh, he'll be a, you can construct, you know, you can construct the anatomy of a girl, so just let him be female, which would somehow be better than being a guy with a serious injury. This did not go well. It is so screwed up. It's a story that NBC had covered in the late 90s. I didn't work on it at the time, but I do remember it. And I was really looking into that story and doing research around it and what its kind of modern relevance would be, because really all the key players in that story have subsequently passed away. It's also an incredibly, like, wrenchingly depressing story. It's so deeply sad. And so I was kind of like, what's the modern take on this? And one thing that I actually did was watch through all the field tapes, everything, because it was an NBC story. I had everything they had filmed, not just what appeared on the air. And I watched the full, both full interviews with this young man who eventually found out what happened to him, started doing corrective surgeries to move back to living as a man, and had subsequently taken his own life because of all of the pain surrounding his entire childhood. And in the interviews, he mentioned that the reason that he decided to come forward and talk about what had happened with him and disclose his own identity, show his face on camera, was that he had learned that the misreporting about his case had been used in medical journals to say, oh, see, you can raise a boy as a girl and it's all fine. So the implication was that, like, for intersex children, you can just pick a gender, usually girl, because that is easier. That's sort of medically easier.
Yeah.
If there's any lack of clarity, rather than waiting and seeing, like, how the child identifies, what you do is, you know, as a baby or child, just turn this child that there's some lack of clarity on by the doctors, turn the child into a girl, raise her as a girl, don't tell her anything, give her surgeries, give her hormones, do a whole psychological thing, just like they had done to this child, David Reimer. And that'll all be, you know, swell, was the theory. And David Reimer understood that because his case was always told anonymously, he also had a twin brother, so it was like a little twin study worked in there. Because the case had been reported without any names attached, it was able to spread in the journals that this case had been a success when in fact it had been a failure. And as a result, it had been used as justification for literally thousands of unnecessary surgeries. He thought that was bad. You can see, because he appears in the middle of the film, like, this is someone whose sadness is not far from the surface. You really see how he has struggled with this incredibly difficult life. And, he was upset. He didn't want the suffering that he had experienced to go on to others, and certainly not kind of like because of his case. So he did this incredibly unselfish thing to come forward and talk about the most painful chapters of his life. So that led me to, I was aware of intersex people. I knew what that meant, which I've learned since the film came out, is like many people actually aren't. There's just a general lack of awareness. But I certainly didn't know how much was going on with the intersex rights movement, which over the past 10 years has really blossomed. There's a lot of activists who are out there telling their stories, trying to make society and the medical establishment in particular rethink the way that we handle them. Don't treat a baby born with where there's some ambiguity of gender, don't treat them as a freak or a monster that needs to be immediately fixed. Like, calm down a little bit.
Allow some time to actually organically let that be a decision.
Right. First of all, make the first priority kind of figuring out how to bring in some acceptance and make the child feel good about their own body and not like there's something like horrible and shameful to be buried. And if it's not medically necessary, don't do a whole lot of interventions until it's clear what the child would prefer. Now, this is an intersex variations are quite broad. There are many different kinds of intersex conditions, and there are conditions in which actually an infant would need to have surgery for medical reasons, like to be able to urinate properly. Like there, it's not like surgery is always wrong, but often it's just not necessary, and it ends up almost obviously, but somehow this isn't how we've seen it. It ends up creating more problems than it solves.
How did you kind of, when you decided with the three participants to tell their individual stories, how did you approach and make sure that they felt comfortable telling such a unique and personal story to such a large scale? Because some people have had to keep this to themselves or from family or from friends their whole life, and then to actually try and earn their trust in you as the storyteller and the filmmaker. How do you go about even engaging with them on that level that they respect and earn your trust pretty quickly? Because obviously time is important when making a film, and it's so important you get the true representation of these people.
Yeah. I mean, I would say the main method for that was, there were sort of two main things. First of all, working with a consulting producer who herself is intersex, who could give me insight into what I shouldn't do. Also what I should do, but a lot of what I shouldn't do. A lot of intersex people have had quite bad experiences with the media in the past, which I was hoping not to repeat. You know, journalists and filmmakers don't have the equivalent of a Hippocratic oath, like first do no harm, but like that doesn't mean we can't function that way. And that was something in my mind. Like, if in the end what I'm doing is re-traumatizing people, then I'd actually rather just skip the whole project.
Of course.
So that's one thing. But I really think the main thing was the selection of the participants.
Yeah.
I was choosing people who, I mean, there are plenty of intersex people who are not activists. There are also plenty of intersex people who are not out about intersex. I was not trying to pull anyone out of the shadows, nor was I even trying to talk to anyone who was kind of new, brand new to talking publicly about their bodies. The people, you know, because this is kind of a new movement that has to do with generational understanding of things, there are lots of I think there are going to be many more intersex activists in the coming generations. And I certainly met people in their, you know, teens and college age who I sort of decided I only wanted to be working with people who were over 30, because I wanted people who had some maturity and who had talked publicly about their own bodies in the past. Because I didn't want their first experience with that to be with a documentary that I understood was going to be relatively high profile. I mean, Focus Features came on before we started filming, so I understood this is something that, like, oh, you know what, this is going to be released in, you know, theaters, it's going to be on streaming services. Actually, in America right now, it's on airplanes. So, like, if you're just getting sort of your sea legs in terms of talking publicly, like sort of having being,
it's going to be a big deal. Yeah,
is not going to. This is not the place for this to happen. So, two of these activists were very experienced with talking about their bodies and activism. The third, River, is an actor who had actually made a short film about being intersex and had done like a bit of a press tour related to that. So they understood how these things unfold. And interestingly, beyond that, I didn't need, I thought I was gonna, I had this whole sort of roadmap of like, oh, I'll kind of start with just building trust. Like, I had even said to our cinematographer, like, you know, for these first few days of shoots, I don't actually care if we get anything we can use. I just want the participants to feel good about how it went and to not feel intruded on. Now, those early days of shooting were actually when we filmed kind of the main interviews where the participants appear, their faces are quite close up on camera. We had done those with all natural lighting, like no artificial lights brought in, just like a loft room that had a nice window, because I just didn't want to make it feel all like intrusive. We set up the shot and then the crew actually left and I was behind the camera, like just to make the whole thing feel more comfortable and have it not mirror the early medical experiences that I understood from our consultant and others that intersex people experience, where basically a doctor or nurse is doing an examination and then calls in all of their colleagues or even, medical students on their rounds saying like, hey, come in here, like, come look at this, like of a, you know, a naked child. Like who, like, how did it not occur to people? I would guess that is happening much less now. But you know, for these people who were children 25 years ago, that was something they experienced frequently and it was traumatizing. So I was, you know, when people had explained that to me before we started the project, I had a little bit of a panic attack because I realized like, oh, that what they're describing is so much like what it is like to be, you know, lights are shining on you, everyone, and there's like a whole big group of people behind you who you can't really see behind lights and equipment who are all looking at you. Like, we need to make this the interviews be done somewhere else. So I wasn't really sure what material we might get in those early interviews. My questions were very broad, just like, tell me about your childhood and like whatever they say, we'll just see. And those interviews, they ended up, you know, they understood I was making a film about them being intersex. So, and they're used to being asked a lot of questions, you know, by doctors, by journalists, or by literally anyone here who hears that they're intersex, just like often just jumps in and starts asking about their body. So, you know, almost naturally, they talked quite openly. And yeah. I was really surprised by what beautiful, thoughtful articulators all three were of their own experiences.
That's lovely. And it's something I always try and get my head around, and I've obviously not made a documentary, but it must be such a challenge to edit it down to sort of 90 minutes. When you have a story, especially with three main stories to be told within the main story, it must be an editor's nightmare to keep trimming parts off, to keep cutting scenes out, to make it a realistic kind of running time. And I'm sure when you started, there could be a story here that could be 4 hours long. So it must be many sleepless nights thinking, what can we get rid of?
Well, you know, I actually don't think of it that way. I think if you started off with all this material as a whole and then like trimmed it down, like that's the hard way, and I think not the best way to make it. A documentary really works the other way.
Do you build from nothing?
You start blank and you build from the, but you know there are, it's not like we cut every scene.
No.
We do cut some scenes that we don't use, but in general, like after we've started doing some filming, I start working with an assistant editor before the editor comes in to put together I think these are the moments that really stood out. I think these are the core parts of the story. So let's try to create those, and of those, see what works, and then from that. And this is not, we're not even at that stage. We're not even halfway through shooting. I like to start editing while we're still shooting, so that you can build a few scenes. With the assistant editor, I think we built like 5 or 6 scenes. We saw what worked and what didn't, and that guided us on what else we need to still film and where we're going with our edit.
And as the audience, obviously now, as they're listening to this, will then get the chance to go and check out the documentary, if it's on a plane, if it's from a streaming service, what change are you really hoping that might come from its release?
Yes, or I would say in some theaters in the UK. So I hope people have the
of
chance.
Of course, to, yes. If you can go and sit on the big screen, which is always the best way to see a film or documentary, then do that.
Yeah, you know, I think this film, like, I feel like our bar is kind of low in terms of what it would take to make a difference, because the awareness is so low that even if you just go to a theater and learn about what it is to be intersex and what intersex people are doing right now to advocate for their own rights, like that feels like a big plus. I do think that this is unlike so many subjects of activism these days that feel very hopeless, where you can't see a solution, where it's very hard to see a solution, like how, even if you advocated for everything that people are advocating for, isn't disaster looming? I mean, the Middle East is the big example. Like, isn't disaster looming no matter what happens? It's truly that can be quite horrifying. This is really not true. If in this case, if there was more education, if couples, when they're expecting, were to understand that having an intersex baby is a possibility, it's not your worst nightmare. It's just one of the variations that can happen that presents some parental challenges in the decisions that you have to make. And I think probably the biggest problem for, you know, from the perspective of the person born intersex, is that parental panic, is the idea that like the parents and doctors often have viewed this as a disaster that needs fixing, rather than just a variation that needs a readjustment of thinking. I mean, one of the great slogans that the intersex activists like to use is "fix your hearts, not our parts." You know, I would say that's true, although, I mean, it rhymes. It's more like minds that could use some fixing. Just like, no, just be a little educated. Like, I think if a parent understood that this might happen, it would be a much improved situation when it does happen.
And what is next for you now this is all done? Obviously, you've committed so much of your life to this, and it's finished, and that must feel like a hell of an achievement, but a weight off your shoulders that it's actually all done, it's out there for the world to see. Have you already started putting pen to paper on what you'd like to tell the story of next, or what issues are in your mind that are already current that you might think could make another documentary?
Yeah, I'm working on a number of things. I also work and for some projects as an executive producer on films that first people that are making their first ever documentary, but who have worked in other capacities. It's usually people I've worked with in the past as editors or associate producers. So I'm executive producing some great projects which are coming out next year, and working on developing some, you know, I mean, in the early stages on some other docs that I'm not talking about yet, but sort of a lot of them.
There's a lot of stuff on its way.
Yeah, a lot of them focus back on feminism. The, you know, my film that I made with my sometime filmmaking partner, Betsy West, RBG, led to a number of kind of like amazing women docs, as we've called them. So we're definitely looking into some other amazing women. And I have other subject areas that I'm very eager to plunge into.
My final question for you today, because obviously I can see our time's up, is what I do on this podcast is every guest that comes on, I've done over 313 episodes now. Yeah. Everyone gets the same final question. So you get to choose the song that's played at the end of today's interview. It can be any song by any artist or any band, but it means a lot to you.
Okay, well, okay, there's an obvious one, and it has a British connection. So at the end of our film, for the closing credits, we did something a little bit unusual for a documentary or even a film, where we had the participants and and myself and our whole team and crew come out and take a bow on camera, basically, and dance around a little. We called it frolicking in the film, as you'll see when you see the film, because that term is used. And we felt like it was really in keeping with the spirit of our movie. And the song that we used for that was a cover of Lizzo's Good as Hell by a young British artist named Jordan Smithy.
Nice. Well, I've not heard of this, so it will be now a really good excuse for me to then go down this rabbit hole and discover a new artist and hear some new music.
No, he's amazing, and he does very upbeat songs that are, I feel like, in keeping with the spirit of the films that I've done. I actually found, I was looking for a recording of Good as Hell by a Male Artist and just did a search on YouTube, and I came across Jordan's cover and just loved it. And we were very fortunate that he was willing to license it to us, and that so was Lizzo, for that matter, because it's always great when a pop artist is willing to license their music for your film. So
that's amazing. Julie, I really appreciate your time today. It's a fascinating documentary that I'm really excited to see people's response. I've seen some very early reviews and they're all absolutely glowing, but I love seeing the general public's reviews, and it won't be long until we got to see them online. But I wish you all the luck with this release. It's been a pleasure to speak to you and your dogs. And thank you for your time today. It means a lot. And I hope in the future our paths cross again and we can talk about all these exciting future projects that you've mentioned today.
Good. I hope so too. And it was really nice to speak with you.
So there it is. There's my interview with me and Julie. What a lovely person. Someone I could speak to for hours. So insightful. Such an amazing passion for what she does. And it really shows. Like I said at the start of today's interview, the documentary Everybody is out right now, and please go and check it out. And as always, let me know on any of my social media channels what you thought, because it really means the world if this podcast brings a new documentary or film to you guys that are listening at home. Also, a massive shout out to her dogs that made a cameo on today's performance. Editing this was not my easiest podcast, but they still got to shine, and it was really nice to hear them too. I'd just like to say, if you're listening today and this is your first time on Mark and Me, there's over 300 episodes sitting for you on Spotify, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, and they're all free. So dive in deep and let me know what you think. And also, if you really want to support the podcast, it really helps that I have a Patreon. And that basically means each and every month you can sign up, and there's a link on markandme.com. And what that does, for as little as £1 a month, gives you access to episodes that the general public won't have access to, called the Lost Tapes. You'll also get a welcome pack, which includes a badge, some stickers, and so much more. But all the money that you give me via Patreon goes right back into the podcast. I don't pay myself, but it allows me to go out there and record more episodes for you guys at home. And please, if you're listening today and have enjoyed the episode, just take that time to hit the retweet button on Twitter, share it on Facebook, or like it on Instagram. It goes a really long way and brings a whole new listenership to Mark and Me. And as you know, I'm a one-man team, so any support or any help by sharing these episodes really, really means a lot. Just before I leave today, I just want to say a big shout out to the sponsors of the podcast, Richer Sounds. Each and every month, thanks to those guys, they help me, support me, and sponsor this podcast. So if you're in the market for a new home cinema surround sound system, Sonos, TV, headphones, whatever you want, go on richersounds.com and check them out. And finally, the Folio Society, my favourite book company in the world. They're absolutely amazing. So if you're in the market for a brand new book, hit up foliosociety.com and treat yourself today. Things aren't going to slow down anytime soon. My YouTube channel is growing faster and faster, so if you haven't subscribed to that, go on YouTube, search Mark and Me Podcast and hit that subscribe button. There's a new episode dropping in just a couple of days' time. So until then, look after yourself, take care, and I'll speak to you all very soon. I do my hair toss, check my nails, baby, how you feeling? Check my nails, baby, how you feeling? Woo, child, tired of the foolish, going, dust your shoulders off.